Tonight it's my very pleasant task to open this conference on a cosmology of inner space, the Gnostic vision of Jung's psychology in the world today. It means a great deal to me that this can happen in Chicago, for Chicago Jungians have always been associated with pioneering, which means to me to bring something old and valuable into a new place. To help bring Jung's ideas to Chicago was and still is a major theme in my own life. I remember when I returned to Chicago from Zurich after having completed my analytic training. That was in 1964, a time when Jung's name was not very well known, and his ideas were mostly gleaned from his detractors, the already established psychoanalytic community. Jung's works were at that time just beginning to be translated into English, because Jung's fresh and dissident views threatened the psychoanalytic establishment. Most of what you heard about Jung in those days was extremely negative. Today, as you so well know, that's all changed, as evidenced by the thriving growth of the Jungian community here in this beautiful building, which stands as witness to your devotion and commitment to the psychology of Jung and to those whom he inspired to carry those ideas further. Today, in 1993, when I think about Gnosticism, it seems to me that this ancient religion, philosophy, mythology, symbol system, whatever you want to call it, is in about the same state as was Jungian psychology when our little Chicago study group formed in 1965. Most of what we heard about Gnosticism in the past also comes from its detractors. The early church fathers, for example, who were struggling to establish a new religion and who represented themselves as the hierarchy of the Orthodox religion, the elect, whose task it was to define the new faith and to set up its creeds and its boundaries. The Gnostics wrote many of them about the same time as the New Testament writings were composed. But the church authorities excluded the Gnostic writings from the canon and pronounced them heretical. The Gnostics believed, and as Jung later affirmed along with Clement of Alexandria, whom he so often cited, that he who knows himself knows God. In other words, the path to the holy lies within the human soul. If everyone felt this way, there would be little impetus for building great cathedrals or for supporting an expensive church hierarchy. Consequently, the ideas of the Gnostics were not approved by the nascent church, nor were many of the ideas of the nascent church approved of by the Gnostics. We only knew what we did about Gnosticism from the established church position toward it, because the original Gnostic documents disappeared, and only the critical commentaries were left to stand. In 1945, some Egyptian peasants came upon a cache of Gnostic books that had been hidden in great earthenware jars in a place near Nag Hammadi in Upper Egypt. After much intrigue and dickering, scholars finally got their hands on this largest body of original Gnostic material that had been seen heretofore. These books were first published in English translation in 1978. Their publication launched modern Gnostic studies and exposed a movement whose teachings are in many ways as relevant today as they were nearly 16 centuries ago. There was an old prophecy that foretold that the books of the Gnostics would again see the light of day when the world arrived at a state of readiness to hear their messages. What a coincidence, what a meaningful coincidence that those Egyptian peasants stumbled upon those jars and broke them so that the books poured out in a gushing stream, and that this happened just at the end of the Second World War, after the Holocaust and after we had dropped our atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a time when human beings had reached a new low in our capacity for unleashing horror on our fellows. These writings only now begin to seep into the literature of the mainstream. We must have needed some distance, like abused and violated children, before we could look psychologically and with some objectivity upon what the unspeakable assaults of war and degradation have done to our souls. I chose to talk to you tonight about one book from this Nag Hammadi library, The Exegesis on the Soul. In my new book, A Gnostic Book of Hours, I rephrased certain texts, among them the texts in this exegesis, to find the hidden poetry in the translations. This is a short tale narrating the Gnostic myth of the soul from her fall into the visible world and her return to heaven. People in antiquity understood the soul in not so very different a way as we understand her. She is the non-material essence of our beings, what Jung called the anima, or the animating principle. She thrives in inwardness and lives in our deeply felt sensibilities for passion and pain. The old Gnostics had a way of explaining the soul that I find very helpful. It follows a Neoplatonic tradition which posits a tripartite character for every person: body, soul, and spirit. These three aspects live in each of us, but we don't necessarily accord each one the same degree of importance or prominence. The body, called sometimes the hylic aspect of being from the Greek word hyle, which means matter, is associated with everything material and substantial. The body concerns itself with the realities of this world, making a living, eating, drinking, sex and other pleasures, greed and other vices, politics and public service, institutions and corporations, facts and figures, and so on. We need the hylic part of ourselves in order to carry on our lives in this material world.